This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. وَمَا تَكُونُ فِي شَأْنٍ وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَمَا تَتْلُو وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater. But it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Tehran and Beijing say they will enhance bilateral relations regardless of the international developments as the Iranian president pays a state visit to China. The death toll from earthquakes in Turkey and Syria passes 41,000 as the UN initiates its largest ever deployment of emergency medical teams to help some 26 million people in need. In turning down the Ukrainian president's demand for fighter jets, Germany says supplying Kiev with warplanes is not a focus at the moment. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is in China on a state visit. He has already sat down for talks with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, as well as other senior Chinese officials. A 25-year cooperation agreement signed by the two countries 2 years ago tops the agenda of Raisi's talks with the Chinese officials. The following report has more.
Ebrahim Raisi is in Beijing for a three-day state visit. That's the first such trip by an Iranian president to China in 20 years. Upon his arrival, he was welcomed by his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. During their meeting, the two presidents sounded determined to strengthen the two countries' partnership, both vowing to work toward implementation of the 25-year Strategic Cooperation Pact, whatever international conditions be.
We believe that implementing the 25-year cooperation agreement and realizing what agreed between the two countries' officials today to develop bilateral ties can promote regional and global peace and stability. Certainly, relations between Iran and China will not be affected by international developments, since we're determined to develop ties with China in any circumstances.
China will continue to be committed to consolidating and deepening relations with Iran. I'm willing to work with President Raisi to enhance strategic communication and promote the steady and sustained growth of the comprehensive strategic partnership between the two countries.
Of course, the two presidents had much more to say. Raisi said there is still much more for expanding economic and trade collaboration between the two sides, adding that such collaboration would contribute to peace and stability across the globe. On the other side, Xi hailed China's growing solidarity with Tehran, saying the two countries have supported each other in the face of complex global challenges. He added that China supports Iran's efforts to safeguard its national sovereignty and independence and counter hegemony and unilateralism. Political analyst Christopher Hilali says further deepening of Iran-China ties will greatly strengthen the developments of a multipolar world.
The deepening of ties further strengthens the development of a multipolar world against what both the Chinese and the Iranians said was the ongoing hegemony and unilateralism of Western domination, specifically led by the United States.
Iranian academic Said Mohammad Marandi, who is accompanying the Iranian delegation in Beijing, says the West's antagonistic attitude has accelerated convergence among Asian nations.
Asia alone, through this natural convergence, which is being pushed forward even faster, largely due to the fact that the United States and the Europeans are constantly antagonizing governments and sanctioning governments, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, and increasingly China, and also by constantly trying to prevent India from establishing greater ties with these Asian powers. The United States and Europeans are pushing these countries towards greater convergence at a faster pace.
Tehran-Beijing cooperation has been only growing over the past couple of years. China has now become Iran's largest trading partner, with figures showing volume of trade between the two rose by over 40% in the previous Iranian calendar year, which ended on March the 20th. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. Iran is also eager to contribute to China's mega project, the Belt and Road Initiative. China and Iran now appear set to take their partnership to the next level for prosperity of their nations.
Palestinians have held a funeral procession for a teenage boy killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Seventeen-year-old Mahmoud Majid succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli raid on the Al-Farah refugee camp near Nablus. The incident came a day after a 22-year-old Palestinian was killed by Israeli troopers in the same city. The regime has been conducting raids across the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. The crackdown has left nearly 50 Palestinians dead since the turn of the year. Israel's far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, says he wants to see more Jewish settlements constructed across the occupied territories. Ben-Gvir said building new settlements is, quote, Israel's mission and doctrine. He said nine settlements are not enough, and the regime wants much more. The minister said Europeans and Americans should, quote, stop worrying. Foreign ministers from Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and the United States have said they are, quote, deeply troubled by Israel's settlement expansion plan. The regime has already authorized new settlement outposts and pledged to construct new settler units in the West Bank. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has called for an end to the settlement expansion. All the settlements are illegal under international law and the Geneva Conventions. The World Health Organization has described a recent devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria as the worst natural disaster in a century.
We are witnessing the worst natural disaster in the WHO European region for a century, and we are still learning about its magnitude. Its true cost is not known yet. Recovering and healing will take time and a phenomenal effort.
In a virtual press conference from London, the WHO director for the European region said the UN Health Agency has initiated its largest ever deployment of emergency medical teams to help some 26 million people in need of humanitarian aid. The combined death toll from the powerful earthquake has passed 41,000. More than 5,800 of the fatalities are in Syria, already devastated by war and racked by sanctions. The UN has called for international funding to help the people in that country.
Good morning. Today, I'm announcing that the United Nations is launching a $397 million humanitarian appeal for the people of earthquake-ravaged Syria.
The UN chief said the funds would bring life-saving relief, including shelter, health care, and food for nearly 5 million Syrians over a period of 3 months. He added that the world body is in the final stage of a similar appeal for Turkey. This as activists and emergency teams have slammed the UN for its slow response to quake-hit areas in northern Syria. The UN has announced the opening of two border crossings from Turkey to ease the flow of aid into northern Syria. Earlier, UN aid convoy arrived in the terrorist-held Syrian areas through the newly opened Bab al-Hawa crossing. Following devastating earthquakes last week, only 9 EU member states have provided emergency assistance to Syria, compared to 21 with respect to Turkey. Legislators have been debating the bloc's response to the humanitarian disaster. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Lives have been saved in Turkey following recent earthquakes because the country had access to heavy lifting machinery. Experts say many lives were lost in Syria because sanctions prevented the country from having similar equipment. The catastrophe has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Following the disaster, I contacted one of the largest aid agencies in Syria. I've spoken to Italian agencies and other NGOs. They all told me that the EU sanctions present an obstacle to humanitarian work.
European Commission officials told legislators that just 9 of the EU's 27 member states have supplied Syria with support. 21 have scrambled to help Turkey.
The Commission also allocated an additional 3.5 million euros in emergency humanitarian funding to help our partners address urgent needs in Syria.
This 3.5 million euro for Syrians pales into insignificance when compared to the 67 billion euro spent by the EU on Ukraine during the past 11 months. Experts have been saying for years that the bloc lacks unity when it comes to Syria.
Countries are acting in their own way. There is no coordinated action. And this is one of the reasons that we're faced with this very big crisis, this mega crisis.
Efforts by Western nations to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have failed. Critics say interventionism has brought misery to millions of innocent people in the country. Some lawmakers want the pressure to be paused.
In Syria, there are sanctions. We don't want to see more people die in the cold. They don't have medicines. We must put politics aside and human life first.
It's been announced the EU will host a donors summit next month to gather money for the earthquake-hit regions. Political commentators are claiming it's already obvious that the vast majority of the money raised will go to Turkey, Syria. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Germany's defense minister says supplying Ukraine with fighter jets is not a focus at the moment, but would certainly be considered. Boris Pistorius told ARD-TV that securing Ukraine's airspace is the priority. The German minister said further steps should be discussed afterwards. German media had earlier said the country's arms manufacturers would refurbish dozens of Leopard 1 tanks to send to Ukraine. Britain and France are also considering plans to set up factories in Ukraine to manufacture weapons. Russia has warned any delivery of British fighter jets to Ukraine would have serious military and political ramifications. Elsewhere, a commission investigating abuse in Portugal's Catholic Church says over 100 priests suspected of child sex abuse remain active in church roles. The commission said it was preparing a list of the accused priests who were still working to send to the church and to the public prosecutor's office. Head of the bishop's conference says as long as it's proven the priest is an abuser, he cannot hold positions within the ministry. The church, however, says that it will not conduct a, quote, witch hunt against its members. On Monday, the commission said it has documented abuse of nearly 5,000 children over the past 7 decades. The abuse took place almost anywhere possible, including at Catholic schools, churches, priests' homes, and confessionals. The majority of cases happen with children aged between 10 and 14. And the United Nations is sounding the alarm over the health and nutrition crises in Afghanistan. The World Health Organization says tens of thousands of Afghan children and women will suffer from acute malnutrition in 2023. Rahmatullah Bahman reports from Kabul.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of beds, and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Indian tax officers raided the BBC's offices in the capital, New Delhi and Mumbai, after the British broadcaster aired a documentary critical of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Police have sealed off the BBC's New Delhi office after the raid. A spokesman for the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party is accusing the network of engaging in anti-India propaganda. The spokesman says the BBC should not spew venom while operating in the country. In a statement, the broadcaster said it was fully cooperating with authorities. Last month, it aired a two-part documentary alleging that Modi pushed police to turn a blind eye to the massacre of hundreds of Muslims in Gujarat in 2002. Modi was the state's chief minister at the time. And Argentina says its inflation rate is almost 100%, with workers' budgets straining as costs outstrip salaries. The inflation rate is the highest since hyperinflation in the 1990s. The South American country also saw monthly inflation speed up to 6% in January. Rampant inflation has slammed the economy, forcing the central bank to raise interest rates to 75%. This has hardly hit the popularity of the center-left government of President Alberto Fernandez ahead of general elections in October. The conservative opposition now leads in the polls, as many blame poor economic management and money printing by the government. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The inaction of the United Nations and the international community has made Saudi Arabia and its allies commit more crimes in Yemen. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Arabic service of Russia's Sputnik news agency has covered this issue and tells us more. Yemen's Ministry of Health has warned that more than 5,000 patients with kidney failure are at risk of death due to a lack of medical supplies in the aftermath of the years-long Saudi blockade and war against the country. The spokesman for Yemen's Ministry of Health, Anis al-Asbahi, raised the alarm on Saturday, as the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen and the blockade of the country's ports drag on for 8 years. The health ministry spokesman, Anis al-Asbahi, warned the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients with renal failure are at stake and threatened with death as a result of the near depletion of dialysis drugs and supplies. He said, "Drugs and dialysis supplies are running out in Yemen, and we do not have sufficient stocks in dialysis centers, except for a few that can only hold out for a matter of months." Asbahi added that If they do not receive an emergency shipment of medicine in the current month, they will face a catastrophe that endangers the lives of more than 5,000 kidney failure patients in Yemen. All these patients need regular dialysis sessions, as well as 500 patients who need kidney transplants. The spokesman for Yemen's health ministry added that 17 dialysis centers will be shut down if necessary medicines and supplies are not delivered to the country on time. Anis al-Asbahi criticized the World Health Organization, WHO, in this regard, saying that despite correspondence with the World Health Organization, it took the United Nations agency a year to provide medicines needed for patients with kidney failure. Asbahi blamed the World Health Organization for its belated response and inaction while it was well aware of the catastrophe caused by the Saudi-imposed blockade on Yemen, the closure of Sana'a's international airport, and the country's dire financial crisis. The health ministry spokesman also accused the United Nations and the World Health Organization of increasing the suffering of Yemeni patients with kidney failure by abandoning them and repeatedly disavowing the patients. The health ministry official has on numerous occasions underscored the importance of opening Sana'a Airport and the port of Hodeidah, as they are vital outlets for medicine and food imports into the country. Earlier this month, Entisaf Organization for Women and Children's Rights said in a statement on the occasion of World Cancer Day that more than 3,000 Yemeni children have developed cancer as a result of the Saudi aggression and the tight sea, land and air blockade of Yemen, and are now at significant risk of death. The rights group criticized the international organizations and other relevant bodies for neglecting Yemeni cancer patients over the years. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with the arms and logistics support from United States, Britain and other Western countries, has launched a devastating war on Yemen since March of 2015. The objective of the war was to crush the popular Ansar Allah movement, which has been running the country in the absence of a functional government, and to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abdul Rabu Mansur Hadi. Yemen's Al Masira television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has strongly condemned Saudi atrocities against Yemeni civilians and African migrants in border regions, calling on international rights organizations to put a stop to the Saudi genocide in Yemen. The Ministry of Human Rights said in a recent statement it was shocked by the silence of the international community and international bodies led by the United Nations in the face of continuing crimes by Saudi Arabia. The statement said, "We remind the world with all of its humanitarian bodies that the victims of the Saudi attack since the beginning of the armistice have reached 2,258, including 285 martyrs in the border directorates of Sa'ada, and the death toll is still rising." It further lamented that artillery shells and machine guns are still raining down on the heads of innocent Yemeni civilians and immigrants, while most severe forms of torture and abuse are being practiced against them. Launching a humanitarian appeal, the ministry further called on the free world and rights organizations to move in accordance with their humanitarian principles to condemn such crimes by Saudi Arabia and its allies and hold the perpetrators accountable. It also renewed the call on competent bodies and all humanitarian and international organizations to investigate Saudi crimes in border areas of Yemen, including the killing and torture of citizens and displaced people in the light of the high toll of victims and the scarcity of medical supplies in the country. Abdullah Musri, director of Razir Rural Hospital in Yemen, added that at least 907 people were killed or wounded during the United Nations brokered truce that lasted 6 months and expired on 2nd of October. While the Saudi-led coalition has failed to meet any of its objectives, The war in Yemen has killed hundreds of thousands of innocent people and spawned one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. The website of Al Mayadeen television network has also covered this story. According to a Yemeni rights group, more than 3,000 civilians, including women and children, were killed or injured in the airstrikes launched by the Saudi-led coalition against Yemen in 2022. The Humanity Eye Center for Rights and Development issued a report on Monday showing that the total number of casualties was 3,083 during last year's war in Yemen, which included the death of 643 Yemeni citizens and the wounding of 2,440 others. The report said 102 Yemeni children lost their lives and 353 others sustained injuries, in addition to 27 women killed and 97 others wounded. The Yemeni rights group confirmed that 514 Yemeni men were killed and 1,990 others were injured. As for the damage to Yemen's infrastructure in 2022, the report said the Saudi-led coalition warplanes destroyed 14,367 homes, 134 mosques, 5 tourist facilities, 12 Yemeni hospitals, 64 educational centers, 1,987 agricultural fields, and 7 media organizations. The aggression also destroyed 22 power stations, 974 roads and bridges, 46 communication towers and stations, and 334 tanks and water stations, and 57 government buildings. The Humanity Eye Center for Rights and Development also reported that the Saudi-led coalition destroyed many businesses, which amount to 229 business facilities. In addition, the Saudi warplanes targeted 1,022 means of transportation, 29 chicken farms, 37 medicine warehouses, 95 food trucks and 21 fuel stations, and 13 fuel tankers. Also, Abdullah Musri, director of the Razi Rural Hospital in Yemen, said nearly 3,000 civilians, including African refugees, lost their lives or sustained injuries this year as a result of the artillery and missile strikes by the Saudi-led coalition forces. This happened particularly in Yemen's northwestern province of Sa'dar. It said the number of civilian casualties in the Yemeni region stand at 2,909, and that figure covers the period between early January and late December. Abdullah al-Musri said his hospital received 111 dead bodies and 796 injured people, including African asylum seekers, during the United Nations brokered truce that lasted 6 months and expired on 2nd of October. He stressed that Saudi Arabia never committed itself to the truce in the first place, and that Saudi crimes and atrocities continue to this day.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at a news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to examine the attempt by Western societies to impose LGBTQ ideology onto Muslims. Islam has a very clear prohibition on homosexual acts, but despite this, Western nations have been trying to persuade Muslims to abandon their principles, and pro-LGBTQ propaganda is nowhere more evident than in the school system, as the following report explains.
A new challenge faces religious communities in the Western world. A push to introduce controversial same-sex relationship education material onto children at state schools. The issue has become such a hot-button topic that protests have flared up across Britain and in the US in recent years, with a recent example taking place in South Wales.
Please let children be children, say no to RSE and save our children.
Although the issue has upset religious Jewish and Christian communities, Muslims have made the biggest push to challenge what's being described as LGBT indoctrination in primary schools. Back in 2019, UK cities witnessed protest after a UK Birmingham school's introduction of a pro-LGBT curriculum called No Outsiders. In 2021, parents in East London condemned their local school for allegedly sexualizing children with a relationship and sex education lesson, or RSE, which also included same-sex narratives. And in October 2022, hundreds of parents protested in Michigan, USA, over a local school's use of LGBT books. Back in Britain, a school in England's West Midlands sparked a row after inviting a self-described gay Muslim to address Muslim students. His visit was challenged by students and parents. Supporters of the lesson say it's about combating intolerance towards the gay community. However, religious communities say they have a right to practice their faith and raise their children with their own values.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Western nations and LGBTQ propaganda is Shakil Afsar, an activist from Birmingham in the UK, where he closely was involved in protests against LGBTQ teaching in primary schools. And joining us on Skype from Iraq is Sheikh Jafar Ladak, an Islamic scholar and the Imam of Bab al-Ilm Centre in Leeds. Thank you very much for joining us on the show, Shakil. It's a pleasure to have you. Now, just tell me, let's go back, 2019, I think it was, the issue in Birmingham. There's a massive protest movement with Muslims up there. Tell me your experience.
Well, to be honest, it was a group of parents who were just standing up and asking for the same privilege the LGBT community have been fighting, well, apparently fighting for many years. Parents were only reiterating the fact that their children are very young, that this is a very sensitive subject, and that the fact that they feel that their religious, moral and philosophical convictions are being watered down. My actual feeling towards this all was there was a barbaric amount of discrimination from the LGBT community towards these innocent parents who were only standing and trying to defend the innocence of their children. It was so bad to the point where we were labelled extremists, we were labelled bigots. You know, people were being stopped and, you know, questioned on what jobs they do, where they do, being referred to prevent. It was an absolutely dreadful time.
So basically, for expressing your freedom of speech, for your own views on the subject, parents were being branded extremists and terrorists.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a group of people who are claiming equality, but then are completely disallowing what we believe. They claim tolerance, but are being completely intolerant towards our beliefs. We have never, as people from Birmingham and parents, I can vouch that we have never questioned the rights or wrongs of homosexuality. According to our religion, it's forbidden, but we have never questioned these people. We have never asked them to stop what they're doing. We are merely and are still asking them to stop indoctrinating our children and pushing their worldviews on our innocent, young, innocent minds. You know, if it was they were a bit older, we would have enough time to educate our children about Islam or Christianity or any other Abrahamic faith. But the fact that this is being pushed, I actually believe that there is a bigger agenda to water down our religious values of British Muslims. And this is in overdrive. It's complete overdrive.
And obviously this was the No Outsiders initiative, which was being pushed into schools in Birmingham.
Absolutely.
Which was mentioned in the report.
Absolutely.
What kind of stuff was going on in No Outsiders?
Well, look, young Muslim children whose parents are praying namaz five times a day, the children were coming home with books such as Princess Boy, which would suggest a transgender lifestyle, a boy dressing as a girl being acceptable. Mm. Parents were horrified. These are parents who wake up at the crack of dawn to, you know, pray to their Lord, ask for forgiveness and try to be good, peaceful human beings. And their children are coming home with books that are completely contradictory to everything that their religion says.
I think one thing that bothers a lot of parents as well is the fact that it's introduced in primary school. So it's quite a young age we're dealing
with.
And I think a lot of parents were saying like they didn't want any relationship education at that age, regardless of same gender or not. Before we carry on the talk, Shaquille, let's bring in another voice onto this issue. We have a Sheikh Jaffa Ladak coming to us via Skype from Iraq. Welcome to the show, Sheikh. Thank you for joining us. First of all, why are Muslim parents so upset by this RSE curriculum, in your view? What's the big issue?
The development of a child goes through stages. And there are times in which a child is capable of understanding something fully, where a child has to learn something at a preparatory stage, and other times when a child cannot be talked to about certain things because the mind is maybe ill-prepared or immature to be able to understand what it's being told or the images that it's consuming. And we know that from all sorts of social studies. If you show children acts of violence, for example, they think that this is normal and they will adopt those actions without realizing the consequences of it. If a child sees another child pulling someone's hair or hitting someone, and they're not taught that these behaviors are not correct, then they adopt these for themselves. It becomes part and parcel of whom they are. In the same way, of course, every human being has innate nature, desires, curiosities. The fear that many parents have is, along with the decoupling of traditional moral understanding, the fear that parents have is that certain educational ideas are heaping content, especially same-sex content, content for exploring one's body, being able to be completely free and open in children when they are not yet mature enough to understand the content or the consequences of those content. And as a result, parents are protesting. Parents are pulling their children out of school. Some parents are even leaving the country out of fear of what the medium to long-term moral situation of the country will be like.
Another example of what's been going on is an effort that was made last year at a UK school to essentially reinterpret the Quran from a pro-LGBT position. Is there any room for debate on this subject, Sheikh?
The Quran places the identity of a human being in relationship to his creator, God Almighty. As an example, we get this from the verses that speak about the Mi'raj, the ascension of the blessed Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him and his noble family, where the verse says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Subhanalladhi asra bi'abdihi layla min al-masjid haram ila al-masjid al-aqsa. That blessed is he, the Prophet, the servant of Allah who went on this journey. The point is that even the peak of creation, the best of creation, was referred to as his identity as a servant of God alone. What we're seeing here is that some of these movements are seeking to shift the identity of a person and subsume them either within a sexual identity or within a gender-based identity or even sometimes based on pronouns, sometimes even further, God forbid, people are identifying themselves as animals and things like this. So from the Islamic perspective, our identity is not one that is created and shaped and reshaped by social ideals of the time. We have this until today. This might be a little bit controversial, but try to understand it. When we say, I am white, or I am black, or I am brown, there is no such thing. It's just the melatonin of my skin, right? There's no such thing as a black person or a white person per se. It's just the melatonin or lack thereof in my skin. There's no such thing as a Pakistani or an Iraqi or an Arab. These are social terms that we have created for ourselves. In Islam, our identity is related to God. Our identity is related to our religion. And so when a Muslim or non-Muslim comes forward and says that I can be this type of person or I can be that type of person, I have to think about whether this is social conditioning or whether this is actually something that is within the framework of the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his family. And those who try to start by saying, I am this type of Muslim, or I am with these sorts of pronouns, we have to recognize that these things are social constructs. They have no value in and of themselves, and sometimes they're actually in direct conflict with Islam. I would argue that in this case, when this person came and said, I am a gay Muslim, to place the idea of his sexuality and his gayness or his lust for fellow men ahead of his Islam, or to subsume his Islam within that identity, is something that is not acceptable within Islam and actually goes against Islam.
And finally, given that the UK is a secular country, should Western Muslims be more tolerant of this type of education, would you say, Sheikh?
But if a society is truly secular, then it allows for that space for there to be sort of a battleground of ideas, a marketplace of ideas. And if one group of people want to be able to put forward their ideas as robustly as they are, and we can see in the LGBTQ community that it's being supported to the tune of hundreds of millions of pounds. It's being supported with a great amount of media landscape. Then from the same perspective, it's truly a secular society, and truly it should be a marketplace of ideas. The traditional values of religion and family and the evidences these communities have on this side should be as forthcoming and as welcomed as any other sort of idea. I should feel free to be able to put forth my understanding of this matter as well as somebody else. But the fear that we have at the moment, that many Muslims have, is that if they speak about their traditional family values, about their religious values, starting from the perspective of God, what is right, what is wrong morally, the Muslim society at the moment feels very shut down. In fact, it actually feels under threat.
Well, thank you very much, Sheikh. We'll have to leave it there for now. But thank you for joining us via Skype, and apologies for any technical issues that occurred during the talk. Well, before we continue this discussion, let's take a look at what people on the streets of London have to say about this.
I don't think it's appropriate to put LGBT into the curriculum. I think there are far more important things than LGBT. Teaching children at an early age about gender is quite confusing for them. And because the child's brain doesn't develop till the age of 27. So there's a lot of confusion that can take place. So why not teach them how to look after themselves, nutrition, teach them how to cook, yeah? Teach them how to look after their money, teach them about finance, teach them about the big wider world, which is far more important.
If they're at a young age, I'm against it, of course, because the children, they don't have right for like having an opinion. So they have like their parents that support or against it, so they should take their parents' permission before asking or pursuing any of that in the education system. It shouldn't be like taught straight to kids without the consent or any form of agreement from the parents.
Personally, I don't think so, especially at like primary school level. I don't think it's necessary. maybe a little bit older to understand what's happening and that there are people like that, but I don't think, especially as young children.
I disagree with them, especially in the primary school. They start to teach them, taught them from reception, maybe nursery. Yeah, I was working in a nursery and they started the big, this, what they say it, like a rule or regular to do it. But I disagree with them. It's still a small children. They can't make their own decision. They should be like maybe bigger enough. If some child asks, maybe they can answer him. But if not, why you put these children in this situation? I don't like it. I disagree with it. 100%.
I don't think it's appropriate because they're really young, and also some people are different religions and they don't agree with this stuff and they're still talking about it. So I think it's a bit rude that they're talking about it when everybody doesn't agree with this. I was taught about it, I think, 2 months ago. I felt a bit awkward since I'm a Muslim. I don't agree with this type of stuff. And they kept talking about it, saying that we should be nice about it. Obviously, we should, but it just felt really awkward in the situation.
In an apparent effort to tarnish parent protests, media pundits and LGBT activists have described critics as radical extremists. However, it isn't Muslims only who are concerned by this issue, as a British Jewish activist made clear to us earlier on.
Jewish people are generally very, very concerned about this. I live myself in Gated. And I actually admire you very much that you're actually involved in this. It's a very, very important thing. And what I want to point out as a Jewish person, this is not just a Jewish issue. And I want to speak, before I speak, I'll give a disclaimer, then I'll show you how. I'm not representing an organization. I'm not representing any other person other than myself. But on the other hand, I am representing humanity. This is not just a religious issue. This is an issue which is literally an issue which affects humanity. Anybody who can speak up is speaking up for humanity. He's not speaking up necessarily, he's speaking up for religion, he's speaking up for God, yes, but he's speaking up for humanity. And this also puts into question a very, very, very big, in a very big way, that until now the narrative they've been giving us is that they're doing this because they're concerned about terrorism and extremism. This, they cannot say this anymore, because even the doctors who were told that they were actually going to be teaching this stuff, most of the doctors were not interested.
Well, we're going to head back to the discussion now of our in-studio guest, Shaquille. So, Shaquille, we heard from people from the streets of London. It seems to me as if a lot of parents, particularly, are just kind of creeped out by the idea that kids so young are being introduced to any kind of relationship education, let alone this particular same-gender identity.
You're absolutely right. Like I said, a parent, especially the mother, bears this child with the most excruciating pain, and then the fact that that child's is her responsibility to nurture physically, nurture mentally. If there's any issue with that child, she will be responsible. But when that mother becomes concerned about her child's mental welfare, the things that her child is learning, and then the fact that it could put the child in a worse position, she's completely disallowed and called a radical, called an extremist. And this is a woman who has bared this child through the most excruciating pain any human body could endure. And then, you know, it's absolutely discrimination, open discrimination.
And I think that another strange aspect to all this is the fact that basically the state is intervening to teach other people's kids about relationships and so on, when the parents don't even seem to be consulted. Were the parents being consulted in
Birmingham? This is where the major issue started for us in the city of Birmingham, was the fact that young children were coming home with sensitive books like Princess Boy, like my cha-cha, which means my uncle in Asian, is gay. Parents were, you know, horrified. Parents were very concerned that the fact that RSE has a 52-page guidance sheet. No curriculum has a 52-page guidance sheet, yet RSE comes with a 52-page guidance sheet teaching the people who will be delivering it how to do it, how to be mindful, how to keep age appropriateness to account, and moreover, consultations. People in sensitive areas must be consulted, but no. Any parent that speaks up is labeled an extremist. And I'm very glad that you posted this video about walking around the streets, because we did the same thing with one of the mainstream channels, and they didn't air it. Every person they were questioning, majority of them being English Christian or English people, and they categorically said, no, primary school is not the age to be teaching such sensitive subjects to any child. You know, let them be innocent. Let them have that right to be children. We're moving sexualization from the back of the child's mind right to the front at such an age when UK has synonymously known to have underage pregnancies. UK, it's all the evidence is there, yet they continue to push it. They continue to force it, majority on ethnic minority and people of Abrahamic faiths.
It is interesting. Public opinion does seem to have a massive appetite for debating this issue at the very least.
Absolutely.
A recent petition got well over 100,000 signatures, and it was calling for a ban of LGBT relationship education in the RSE curriculum. Let me quickly ask you about the media reaction that you received. You was a big activist in Birmingham at the time.
Yeah.
How did the media treat you?
The media completely vilified me. Every single report or any single interview that I did, at a point I had to get my own teams recording it because of the fact of how much was being chopped and changed. I was smeared to be some sort of criminal. I was smeared to be bringing gangs of mobs of people. And these are brothers and sisters of the children who are at the school. These are mothers and fathers, uncles, grandparents of the children who are at the school. And, you know, they've completely vilified me to the point where I had police markers on my car. I had police markers on my children's school. A lot of people completely disallowed the fact when I said, I have children of my own. On this particular school, it was my niece and nephew, which are as good as my children. But I have kids on my own. I know how a parent feels when your child is being indoctrinated so, you know, viciously. You know, it wasn't even a subtle, it was a vicious indoctrination. Mm. You are a girl today, or you can maybe be a boy tomorrow. This was the level the schools were going. And there is, unfortunately, a massive LGBT extremist lobby. Now, for me personally, as a parent, I don't mind what people do in the comfort of their own homes, as long as they don't force that on me. But there is an extremist lobby which is lobbying around majority Muslim areas. We are the only last religion who are keeping their morals intact, who are keeping their philosophical convictions intact and will not bend them. Yeah. But effectively, what the state is doing is teaching Muslim children, when you say to a Muslim child, it's okay to be homosexual, it's equivalent to teaching them it's okay to eat pork, or it's okay to drink alcohol, or it's okay to commit fornication without, being in the confines of marriage. It's absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, because obviously it's supposed to be a secular society in the sense that you have a right to practice your faith without someone forcing their views down your throat.
Absolutely.
And it seems strange to me as well that you have the LGBT side of the argument claiming that actually it's religion forcing their views onto the LGBT community. But actually, it appears that this is the reverse case, where actually they're forcing their views onto our kids.
Absolutely.
And trying to get kids being taught by teachers and strangers, essentially. Shaquille, I'm going to have to end it there because we have run out of time, but
brilliant.
I really appreciate you being with
thank
us.
Thank you very much.
And yes, thank you to everyone at home, and thank you to the guests, of course. For now, that's it, but we will be back next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Salaam alaikum for now.
In the limelight.
A new survey has shown that economists consider the probability of recession in the United States to approximately 70% in 2023. Also, nearly 9 out of 10 Americans are worried about economic recession, while 2/3 of voters believe the country's economy is in recession. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Hill newspaper has covered the story. According to a survey conducted by the National Association of Manufacturers, 62% of manufacturers expect the U.S. economy to enter a recession this year. The survey also found that 69% of manufacturers have a positive outlook for their company, the lowest figure since the third quarter of 2020. They cited struggles in attracting and finding workers, continued supply chain problems, and high raw material costs. It's the latest warning sign that the U.S. manufacturing industry is slowing down amid weakening demand and higher borrowing costs stemming from the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes. The Institute for Supply Management said on Wednesday, 4th of January, that manufacturing contracted for the second straight month in December and reached its weakest point since May of 2020. To add insult to injury, some of manufacturers' top priorities fell flat at the end of last Congress, including changes to taxes, permitting and immigration policy. Congress refused to scrap new rules implemented this year as part of Republicans' 2017 tax bill –